not work have been engaged by the Democratic National Committee for a talk by the Honorable Harold F. Hickey, Secretary of Interior, going to speak tonight at the Municipal Auditorium Convention Hall in St. Louis. At the present time, the Right Honorable Mayor Bernard F. Hickey is addressing the convention hall.
My fellow Americans, we have the high honor tonight of extending a hearty welcome to the distinguished Secretary of the Interior. Since the beginning of the present Democratic administration, he has served at the nation's capital. Under his administration, there have been no teapot dome or Elk Hill scandal. But on the contrary, our national resources have been used or preserved for all the people, as is typical of the New Deal. Our city of St. Louis is not strange to him, nor is he a stranger in our midst. Since the origination in August of 1934 of the Public Works Administration, of which Mr. Rickey was made administrator, the city of St. Louis has made public improvements, including hospital buildings, parks, playgrounds, grade separations, to a grand total of approximately $34 million, of which almost $11 million were the amount contributed to St. Louis by the federal government. All this work, done by union labor, gave direct employment to many men aside from those employed in the production of materials for this improvement. It is my privilege to present to the audience assembled here and to those listening on the radio, all of whom I know appreciate his cooperation, the Secretary of the Interior, Honorable Harold L. Hickey.
That Wendell Willkie, the oratorical acrobat, has passed this way. If he were only here tonight, we could discuss many issues. I could dispose of his indispensable man sneer at the president, but he has done that himself. Mr. Willkie loudly announces that he himself is not indispensable, and the people completely agree with him. So, since even Mr. Wilkie believes that he is dispensable, that disposes of him and leaves only President Roosevelt. We could also compare Mr. Wilkie's promises to befriend labor with his record establishing 5 company unions. Or we could nail a few of the deliberate falsehoods that he has spread about the president's defense program and his foreign policy. But since Mr. Wilkie is a Simon Pure product of public utilities, and since he's had so much to say about city machines and political ethics, we may, for good purpose, devote ourselves tonight to the consideration of the sinister influence of public power, privately owned, as Mr. Wilkie loves to put it, in American politics. Political purity has interested Mr. Wilkie, I don't know why I call him Wilson, poignantly, but he'd be just as sweet by any other name. Since the carefully staged and well-financed public uprising at the Republican Convention in Philadelphia that brought home the bacon to a man who had not dared to submit his name to the Republican voters at a single primary. I readily admit that Mr. Rookie knows more about corrupt city machines than President Roosevelt does, because all that the president has done was to fight them from the outside for the last 30 years, while Mr. Wilkie, as a utility frontman, has had to know much about them from the inside. When Mr. Wilkie went to New York to live, he became a member of the Tammany Organization. The first time that I said this, he replied that it was a simple falsehood. But he has not dared to repeat his denial, which was a deliberate untruth, since he was confronted with the photostat of the official certificate of his election as Democratic County Committeeman of the 15th Assembly District in New York, which is a part of the Tammany organization. If I correctly appraise the campaign of Wendell Rickey of Tammany and Wall Street, he has tried out all of the issues that there are, to say nothing of raising a few fancy false ones, and has concluded that the one way to be sure of carrying Maine and Vermont is to make an attack on those big city Democratic machines with which he himself has not been affiliated. Why bless his crusading soul? Doesn't he know that it was a district attorney appointed by President Roosevelt who sent Tom Pendergast and his gang to the federal penitentiary? Who destroyed the corrupt machine inherited from Huey Long that was looting the state of Louisiana? Who sent its Alabamas to a federal prison? The Department of Justice under President Roosevelt. I might add that it was the Roosevelt administration that sent to the penitentiary Mo Annenberg, the biggest income tax cheater in history, the man whose racing dope once kept all of the pool rooms in the country going, and the man who, with Joe Pugh, constitutes the backbone of the Republican machine in Pennsylvania. Corruption and graft are neither Democratic nor Republican. Sometimes they are one, sometimes they are the other. When the Republican Party rules the nation, the corrupt machines are mostly Republican. When the national pendulum swings Democratic, they tend to be Democratic. Corruption and graft are nonpartisan. They are bipartisan, working both sides of the street at the same time. I can tell you whose baby the corrupt political machine is, or at least I can name its paternal ancestors for two generations back. Its grandfather is the railroads of America. Its father is the public utilities. In this matter of corruption in American politics, there are always two gangs, those who are corrupted and those who do the corrupting. I say, without fear of successful talent, that the most corrupting influence in American politics today, city politics, state politics, national politics, is that of the Public Utility Corporation. Mr. Workey has a lot to say about the corrupted, but nothing about the corruptors. Yet he knows that when a public official is bribed, that official doesn't bribe himself. This price is paid in dirty money by those who want either protection or a special privilege, something that they are not entitled to, either in law or in equity. The railroads taught the public utilities how to corrupt our political life, and the public utilities outdid their teacher. The public utilities joined in the corrupting of American politics at the very time that the railroads were at the peak of their political power. The railroads bought and coerced state governments, while the utilities were bribing city councils and city bosses. That is how the gas and electric companies and the street railways got franchises that made it possible to rob the general public. Some of these franchises were perpetual. Few, if any, provided for just compensation to the people. The public utilities were, and they still are, the real power behind the political bosses who get rich through politics. These same utilities are the real power behind Wendell Rickey. In the city of St. Louis, there was once a powerful political machine that was finally crushed by Joe Folk. It was a public utility machine. The boss that Joe Folk sent to prison was the paid servant of the public utilities at Rural St. Louis. Boss Butler was convicted for accepting bribes from four St. Louis public utility companies. 20 years ago, the public utilities were bribing city councils. Today, they are ruling or trying to rule state governments and are fighting against national regulation. To do this most effectively, they are trying to seize control of the federal government itself. To protect themselves against the corrupt influence of the utilities in city politics, the people try state regulation. At once, the gas and electric companies and the street railways turned from local politics to state politics. All that they had to do was to get their men onto the State Public Service Commission, control a committee or two in each house of the state legislature, and, if possible, see to it that the governor was a reasonable man. Also, during this period, they developed the technique of making campaign contributions to the war chest of both parties. The Republican Party. And in the same campaign, Insull had also contributed 15th Brennan, the Chicago political boss who was running for senator against Frank Ellis, also gave money to the Dineen Pact. After all this had become a mess, and even after Mr. Insull had become a fugitive from justice, after his holding company empire had burst scandalously, Mr. Wilkie, the greatest crusader since Peter the Hermit, referred to Samuel Insull as a forceful, dynamic, and attractive figure. Let me describe to you, in the words of former Governor Gifford Pinchot of Pennsylvania, the political conditions created by the public utilities in that state. I quote from his message to the Pennsylvania General Assembly on January 24, 1927. The Public Service Commission of Pennsylvania has done little to protect the rights of the people and much to ensure and increase the profits of the corporations. As the men in the street well know, the plain people will be better off with no public service commission at all than with a commission the majority of whose members and at present are mere speaking tubes for the public utility. The fact is, I'm still quoting from Governor Pinchot, the fact is that the Public Service Commission of Pennsylvania has been a catchpaw for the corporation. By making use of it, the public utilities have secured better profits from the people than without it they would ever have dared to take for themselves. End of quote. It took 5 years for a reform administration sufficiently to break the power of the utilities in Republican Pennsylvania to investigate the Public Service Commission. What was found in that investigation? I refer you to the Philadelphia Inquirer of August 13, 1932, wherein Governor Pinchot sets forth that James S. Benn, a member of the Public Service Commission for 10 years, had deposited $650,000 in Philadelphia banks during that 10-year period, and that the chairman of the commission, Judge Haney, had deposited $185,000 in 5 years. Keep these facts in mind the next time Wendell Wilkie says that Franklin D. Roosevelt ought to be defeated for president and a public utility holding company lobbyist put in his place. I share for good luck. We get to the bottom of political corruption once in a while, and when we do, we find the public utilities right there on the bottom, the very foundation stone of political corruption. I have referred to the late Samuel Insull, who came a poor youth from England to become private secretary to the great inventor Edison. After he had gone into the power business for himself, Insull quickly formed a crooked alliance with crooked politics to serve his own selfish interests. He built up an unscrupulous power political machine until the day came when he probably held more political power in his hands than any man before him. Power that was bought and paid for at the political bus bar. His political power was not only great, it was sinister. However, you people of St. Louis do not have to go back to Samuel Insull to learn what the public utilities are doing to debauch political life. You don't even have to go back 6 months. I have in my possession a photostat of an article from a St. Louis newspaper of July 19, 1940, summarizing the disclosures in federal court of the way the Union Electric Company collected and spent a corruption fund of $581,000. It happens that it is unlawful for utility corporations to spend money for political purposes. This public utility paid huge sums to lawyers, with an understanding that part of the fees would be kicked back to the company. Its total kickback from lawyers amounted to over $300,000, which constituted a secret fund, not entered on the books, that could be used for corrupt purposes. The Union Electric Company had an expense account. It got kickbacks from insurance companies, and it received a special kickback of $72,000 from a purchasing agent in Kansas City. So far, the SEC and the federal court have not learned how all of this mysterious $500,000 fund has been spent, money that you paid. But all of this sum that has been traced into politics. Part of it was the ordinary anchor to windward stuff. Campaign contributions to both sides in state and city elections. Contributions given indiscriminately to candidates who could or could not be influenced by such gifts. But there was another kind of contribution that thoroughly discredits union elections. Let me quote a few items. $18,000 to Circuit Judge Nick Sevier of Jefferson City for legislative services. Mr. Wilkie, please take notice. With due regard for the sanctity of the court. $7,500 to the State Parole Commissioner for legislative services. $11,000 to Jimmy Miller, boss of the Fourth Ward in St. Louis. For what? Nobody knows, but I've heard that Jimmy used to say about himself, I vote him like a machine. That is some of the work thus far disclosed of the Union Electric Company, the model public utility of the United States of America, the company whose high moral standards were cited in Congress as a reason why there was no need for the Utility Holding Company Act of 1935, which Wendell Willkie and hundreds of political bosses of both political parties tried so hard to defeat. Apparently, the Union Electric Company did not follow Samuel Insull's smart example of making even its junk available for corrupt political purposes. The Union Electric is a subsidiary of the North American Company. You know the North American, the purest holding company in the United States. 99.44% pure. The greatest morality of any natural or artificial person since Caesar's wife. The highest public utility officer yet caught in the Union Electric dragnet is Frank J. Bain, Executive Vice President. I don't know whether anyone higher than he will ever be brought to justice, but I say this to you, that while an Executive Vice President may look like a big shot to the man in the street, he is small potatoes in the holding company game. Nor has any executive vice president of a utility operating company ever collected and spent a $581,000 corruption fund without all of his superior officers knowing about it. It may be that Wendell Willkie has managed his public utilities on a higher political level than those which have achieved such unfortunate publicity in Missouri, Illinois, and Pennsylvania. It may be that he is not merely crying stop thief. However, I have read many times that his Georgia Power Company is the undisputed boss of the state of Georgia, although it has never been strong enough to beat the president. As a force that overawes democracy, Georgia Power has Union Electric licked at least 10 to 1. But until documentary evidence to the contrary is forthcoming, I shall assume that it has achieved its political bossism by the sweet reasonableness of its moral suasion and not by the use of money. Or if money has been used, I feel sure that it was used legally. You can't run a business, you know, without hiring lawyers, and lawyers cannot be bribed. A bribe to a lawyer is a fee. Yet I cannot help wondering what Republican State Senator Earl W. Munshaw of Michigan remarked to Wendell Willkie, chairman of the board of the Consumers Power Company of Michigan, when Mr. Willkie paid him a series of legal fees at a time when important public utility bills were pending in Mr. Munshaw's Public Utility Committee of the Michigan Senate. Here was a concrete example of Mr. Willkie's liberalism. You know that he claims to be a liberal. And he is liberal with his promise. When he is going good, he will promise you anything from a bag of peanuts to a new world. He also gave a nice, juicy fee to a lawyer for services of an undescribed character. And, miraculously, the lawyer's fee found its way into the bank account of the friendly newspaper. Nor was this all that Mr. Willkie did at Chattanooga. His local operating company was forbidden by state law to spend money for election purposes. So Mr. Wilkie got around the law by having his holding company put up the cash. All this was brought out in the congressional investigation of TVA. Checked against the zeal of Mr. Wilkie, the crusader for political purity, another interesting incident brought out in the TVA investigation. A bond election was to be held in Chattanooga, and only property owners were qualified to vote. So a high official of Mr. Wilkie's Tennessee Power Company took title to two vacant lots in the names of more than 100 employees who lived outside of the city limits. Some of these employees actually registered for the election after they suddenly discovered that they were property owners. But the deal was so long that the resulting public outcry forced Mr. Wilkie's subordinates to issue orders that none of the employees should vote. I do not wish to imply that Mr. Wilkie has been an insult or even a tender guest. But the sort of thing that he has done do lead into the abuses which we associate with insult and tender guests. Mr. Wilkie has never fought, at least has never fought openly, the things which insult represented. Remember that in January 1935, after the frightening record of insult had been laid bare to the world, Wendell Wilkie described him as a forceful, dynamic, and attractive figure. What a righteous man was Wendell Wilkie, as he described the burning of the poor hopes in Jersey. Where are your books beginning with the organization of this committee in 1921? They have been destroyed. What is the earliest... record in the way of a book or financial record that is in the possession of your bureau? January 1st, 1928. Now, January 1st, 1928 was the precise date set by the Federal Trade Commission to open its hearings on the efforts of the public utilities to control American politics. Out of fairness to Mr. Wilkie's Georgia Power Company, I should give the alleged reason why these books were destroyed. The witness said that the vouchers cluttered up the office. It never occurred to him, he said, in response to a question, to destroy the vouchers without destroying the books. So they burned the utilities books in Georgia. There is no record that the simple, barefoot Wall Street lawyer ever protested against that bonfire. Never before in our history have we had a utility man, in fact, a holding company front man, running for president. When the fight was on to drive the corrupting forces of the railroads out of politics, the railroads did not have the effrontery to nominate for president the late Commodore Vanderbilt of the public be damned fame. The public utilities today suffer from no such shrinking modesty. With unmitigated gall, they propose that the people, in order to clean up their politics, elect as president a utility lobbyist, Wendell Wilkie, the man of the hell in Chicago fame. Mr. Wilkie loves to speak of himself as a businessman. He has never been in business in his life. He started as a lawyer and ended as a lobbyist and frontman for public utilities privately owned by Morgan and Company. His specialty has been public utility politics, and what he has practiced, he practices now in this campaign. The heavily financed special committees, the chain telegrams and letters, the hired messenger boys tossing paper confetti from office windows. You seem to know something about that here. The alliance with special interests, the secret funds, the whole assorted ugly mess. I do not merely say that utilities do the things that I have described. I say that Wendell Wilkie himself has done them. Wendell Wilkie, as president of the Commonwealth and Southern, led the fight against TVA personally. Wendell Willkie personally signed check that pumped $20,000 into the fake Citizens and Taxpayers League that tried to carry an election in Chattanooga. And Wendell Willkie's company provided the whiskey and fake voters essential to that election. If Mr. Willkie honestly wants to rise above the political morals of the public utilities and politics and join in the fight for better government, he will be welcomed as a soldier in the ranks. There he can prove his right to promotion. Let him climb the ladder step by step if he wants to reach the top. In the greatest crisis of their history, the American people do not propose to supplant President Roosevelt, the best qualified man of our generation, with one who is... so far as public service is concerned, untried, untrue, and unpredictable, whose services, in fact, where they have touched the people, have been against the public interest.
The facilities of the Mutual Network were engaged by the Democratic National Committee for Secretary Itch's address. This is the Mutual Broadcasting System.